All right, Mr. Sachs?
Yes, sir.
All right, levels look good. I have us on YouTube Live, the whole messy process going on right now.
Okay.
Everyone, we have a special Papa's Basement episode for you right now. On the phone with me and Eva Crickson is a friend of mine who's incredibly successful. I know those things don't typically go hand in hand, but he's a very funny man. He's about to release a new audio book on Audible titled Passable in Pink, an homage to the kind of John Hughes films of the 80s, that entire vibe. I want to welcome to the show once again Mike Sachs.
Woo!
Yeah.
Love it.
Yay.
Northern Virginia, baby.
Yeah. Yes. Nova, DMV.
Mike.
Love it.
Mike, you were originally born here, actually, right?
Yeah, I was born in Alexandria. Lived for a few years across from Landmark Mall.
Oh, wow.
And in Virginia Village, it was called. Mm-hmm. And my father worked there until he retired right across from the mall. But then we moved to right over the Potomac into Maryland. So I've lived in Virginia, Maryland, and then later D.C.
Just doing it. I mean, it's no living in Chantilly for the entirety of your life.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll take it.
Well, I got to say, I miss it. I miss that area. I love it.
I know.
My heart is back there. It really is.
What?
Yeah. Eva's rolling her eyes.
No, I'm not rolling my eyes. I'm just dumbfounded. You live in New York. I lived there for a long time. It's my favorite place in the world. I do
really?
Anything.
You didn't get tired of homeless people defecating on the subway?
I actually made a game out of it.
Yeah. I was that homeless
game.
Person.
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Oh, no, go on.
I was going to say, yeah, so I've lived here for 20 years, and I do kind of miss D.C. I really do.
Aww.
Do you have any designs on a return to the area?
Or? Well, my daughter's 10, so I'll be here for another 8 years. And then I was thinking, certainly getting out of New York at that point, whether it's to the D.C. area or to New Orleans, but one of those two areas.
It's funny you mentioned that. Eva's brother actually went to Tulane as well.
Yes, he did for law school. In my research of you, I saw that you were a Tulane grad, and I was like, oh,
yeah.
We have something in common, even though I didn't go there.
So is he practicing in Louisiana or elsewhere?
He is. He's a criminal defense attorney in Louisiana. He has his own practice.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a different law code, right?
Yeah, it's a Napoleonic law.
Really?
Right. Yeah.
Is the guillotine involved?
So if you ever get into any trouble when you're visiting down there, you can call my brother.
Well, I could very keep that in mind.
That's what I love about Mike, because you're a very cerebral, very funny guy, but there's a very, I don't know, like a wild background you have of like drinking and gambling, and I pick it like the more we talk to each other, the more you'll let these little pieces slip that you had a really crazy past, especially in college.
Well, I mean, I was just telling a friend this. This is true. I'm not making this up. I think a lot of it has to do with two things. One is my parents didn't care. I was feral, basically. And the other thing, 100% true, is my mom was a hypochondriac, and she had me on medication for the entirety of my childhood, and it was codeine. I was on codeine for years.
What?
And
my brain is exploding.
I think that cracked my brain, really. I felt my brain sort of crack when I was 16, 17, and I always thought differently, but that was sort of like a real schism. So it was a combination of those two elements that I think kind of certainly helped me become a writer, you know, if anything else.
Oh my.
Nothing else.
It's funny you mention that, because I had the Greek mom, so it's like Jewish mom light, I guess, but worse in its own ways. And I had the nightly Dimetap ritual. I absolutely remember that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. To put you asleep. But I was on codeine for coughs. My mom had a phobia against, you know, lungs and coughing. And all that sort of thing. So I was always on it. And
like
it only occurred to me years later that, holy God, I was on fucking codeine for years.
Oh, my God.
So, hold on. You started, like, each school day with codeine, or it was a nighttime thing, like a nightcap?
Oh, it was three times a day.
What the fuck, how did you function, dude?
Like an IV drip by the time you graduated high school.
I don't think I did function. I mean, I did terribly in school. I was in my own world. I was disassociated from reality in some ways. And it was a very strange childhood. It was just very bizarre. And then, you know, when I got to New Orleans, you know, letting a 17-year-old kid go to New Orleans is just, I think, insanity. I wouldn't do it with my daughter if you paid me anything.
No.
No, my...
And at that time especially, I mean, you got off the plane in the New Orleans airport, and they had hurricanes or any mixed drink you wanted. And they didn't card you, so... It was just constant.
Oh my God.
Sorry, I'm just trying to.
No, I'm. You went there for undergrad. My brother was there for law school. It's sort of, he sort of got his party years out of the way. He certainly didn't when he, you know, went to Tulane, but a 17-year-old, yeah, I don't know how I would have survived there. That's insane.
But it was never like frat party. It was always just like, going to a pool hall or going down to the French Quarter or, you know, knowing a guy named Frenchie in downtown who knew someone who knew someone. I mean, it was just very strange, which is great. I mean, I look back and I was very lucky in some ways, but it wasn't like, you know, an Animal House party. It was more like just weird, very strange. It's a weird city, you know?
It is a strange city. It's unlike any other city in America. That's for sure.
Well, it's a little bit like Arlington, but other than that.
Just a smidge. No, I never pictured like frat parties. It's pretty much what you said. Like, I imagine you cutting most of your classes, like gambling on blood sport. You know, just drunk by 10 a.m.
Yeah, it was awesome, really. I mean, it was like I knew a lot of musicians. I knew a lot of people who were really, really funny, but there was no comedy scene down there then. And I felt really sort of distant because if it feels like a world away from New York or L.A. or California, it's its own reality. And when you're in that reality, that's the entire reality. So I was there for 7 years beyond, and 3 years beyond college.
Oh, you
and
just
it really, I think, it. I hung out afterwards for 3 years, and I think it definitely did help sensibility-wise, you know, coming at life from an outside perspective, which helps with comedy.
So you mentioned that there wasn't a scene down there. How did you actually start? Like, what were your first efforts into the world of comedy?
Well, it was very isolated. I mean, there was... it was just me in a room, and I wanted to write for late night TV. Had no idea how to do it. I didn't know anyone who wrote. I didn't know anyone who knew anyone who wrote. I mean, it felt like a moon, like on the moon. I didn't know how to do it. So I just started doing it for print, hoping that I would be called up from the minors into the majors. And I'm still waiting for that to happen. It doesn't work like that. But by doing that, there was no scene. I didn't come up with anyone. It was just me alone with my codeine and my computer just writing.
Is that the name of a Kanye album? And don't sell yourself short, sir. You just created a very successful podcast audio series with the man who might be in this room. Why not me, too?
Hello.
No, okay, so
but I'll say this too. Like when I moved back to DC, I had worked as you know, a 15-year-old, 16-year-old at Kent Mill Records for years, and then over Christmas breaks and that sort of thing. So when I moved back to DC, I got a job at one of the Kent Mills. There was like 30 at that time, but it was very isolated. I mean, there was no scene at that time. You know, there was the comedy scene was nil. It was Mark Russell and it was Capital Steps and it was Monty Python on PBS Fun Drives. I mean, that was the extent. So I just wended my way through it alone, not knowing what was going on, and just sort of, I don't know, sticking with it, stumbling into, I don't know how you would describe it. It's just, but I still think of myself as just back in D.C. or New Orleans alone in the room, you know, writing.
I really was inspired by the example, like your current writing setup, how you get it done. I would call Mike a lot when we were working on Why Not Me Too,
right.
And dude would just pop on an Orioles game and then just have that on his background noise and write for like the duration every night. It was incredible to me, because I like to think I'm some creative because I do this podcast once a week and then I watch 14 hours of Netflix. You shamed me, sir, and I thank you for it.
Well, it's really about OCD. I mean, I have terrible OCD, and for many years, you know, there's an energy which comes with OCD. And if you don't harness that energy, then you sort of float downstream without accomplishing anything. So I did try to harness that energy into wanting to write and to get things done. And if I don't do it, I'll feel nervous and anxious, rather than, say, you know, touching a door in a certain way or doing this or doing that. It is a strong energy, and I do try to use it for creativity. But it's also easy. I don't have to leave the apartment to go work in a club. I don't have to work in a writer's room. I can sit on my couch, watch the Orioles lose every night, and write. It's very easy. It's not hard.
So let me get this straight, because I actually, as a child, straight up suffered from OCD. I'm one of those rare cases. I don't know, through strength of will or whatever the hell happened, but I don't really engage in my old compulsions. I used to wash the living shit out of my hands. Like, they were just crackled.
Ugh.
It was repugnant. Did you, like, actually engage in that? Or?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, that in particular.
Really?
And also illness, you know, no surprise, growing up how I did.
Yeah.
So I've had it from, I would say, 11. And it got really bad in college. And at that point, I did try to funnel it, instead of feeling the need to do this, to do that, to do this, to, you know, to feel anxious if I didn't accomplish something creatively.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of, you can sort of rewire your brain, I think. It's very malleable, where you can do that. And I do try to tell people who do suffer from OCD that you can sort of create, rather than just sort of circle the drain, you can create from that, and you can turn something bad into something good. But unlike you, mine never went away. I mean, I'm on meds now, and it's, in some ways, it's just as bad, if not worse, than it used to be.
Really? No, mine, for whatever reason, it manifested, I want to say most strongly, like, 7th and 8th grade. I was, like, obsessed with the thought I was going to get AIDS somehow, living in Chantilly and being 12 years old. God damn you, Ryan White. And after that, I went really through even college, like, convinced. Like, I would somehow have unprotected sex with whomever I was with, but then I'd feel very guilty about sleeping with the next girl, because I felt like Telly from Kids. I was like, there's no way I'm not giving this woman AIDS. And of course I'm fine, but yeah, it screwed with me for a very long time, the germ stuff. And like you said, it's much lighter for me. Like, I certainly don't engage in the washing stuff anymore, but I don't know where that, maybe it went into eating compulsive. I don't know what happened.
Let's call a spade a spade.
It did get worse for me in New York, because it's such a filthy city.
I was going to say, why the fuck are you in New York? It's the dirtiest shithole on earth.
No, it's not.
I actually wrote an article for New York Times about that, like how I navigate the filth of New York, whether it's holding onto the subway pole, or, you know, with a paper towel, or opening doors with my elbows.
I do the same shit.
That's amazing.
I put my hand in my hoodie pocket and hold the subway pole that way.
But there's no way to avoid it. I mean, like, I was on a subway not long, actually a couple years ago, and, you know, this Asian kid threw up right near me. Like, right? I mean, like, you can't avoid that, right?
God, that happened a bus ride back from there about 6 months ago. I was with a friend, and a woman just starts emptying out into a lunch bag. And I was like, okay, we're moving.
Oh,
I don't care
God.
If this is rude. Oh. Goodbye. Yeah, I just went to the
Where
back.
Where was this?
Just on a megabus, if I recall.
On the way back from
New
York.
On the way back, yeah. Like, before the bus had even started moving, she's just coughing, and then I hear a full, ah! And I told my buddy, I'm like, we're going to the back of the bus. And he's like, why? Okay. And then I explained someone had barfed. He hadn't even heard it. But yeah, she just filled a trash bag.
Jeez. Well, best thing about that vomiting experience was it was projectile, and he missed me, but it landed on a working woman's, not a prostitute, but someone.
Like a working girl.
Right. Wearing really nice shoes, pumps, and it landed right on him. And she just basically like rolled her eyes like, oh, New York.
Am I right? Do you mentor young writers in comics? Do they like come to you to
You're
seek advice?
You're 35, Eva. Fuck off.
No, not me.
I know.
But like younger men and women, do they seek out your advice?
Well, they do, because I wrote those two books where I interviewed authors, and, you know, some people, they do reach out and look at me as some sort of guru. But the only reason I wrote those books was to have an excuse to interview writers that I grew up liking and liked at the time, and to pick their brains about what to do and what not to do. But I will be approached, emailed. And also, my email is very reachable. I'm not hiding it. Like, I don't understand when writers make it difficult to find their contact information. So it is out there. But I don't mind doing it. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing when I was starting, and I could have used some advice, and just didn't exist, really, when I was – there was no one I could reach out to.
I wanted to reconfirm the title of that first book, Here's the Kicker. And I've gone through poking a dead frog multiple times, but I'm bringing this up because when you Google Mike Sacks, mm-hmm. what comes up is for his author's photos.
Oh, like, I saw. Yeah,
he'll use the photos of various models. It's just, I never get tired of that. Who's the new model? I don't recognize this guy. He used to use John Hamm, but who's the new dude?
Oh, I don't even know. I mean, I don't know. I'm Googling myself right now. I don't
know. That. So this man is an actual man named Mike Sacks that's a lawyer.
Yes. That is a friend of mine named Mike Sacks. I'll tell you what happened there. He is a straight guy, very handsome, was on TV talking about legal aspects. He's a lawyer. So I would get all his emails from gay men. And he would get all my emails from, you know, shut-ins who like Monty Python. So, and it's only one letter differentiating it between us on my Google, Mike Sacks, MikeBSacks@gmail.com. So he's a very handsome guy, and people have thought I look like that, and we're quite disappointed when this Huckleberry shows up in his Orioles.
Oh, God. All right. let's talk Passable in Pink, your newest project. You've done a couple things now, or at least one project with Audible. You had Stinker Let's Loose, which mm-hmm. you originally wrote as a book, and then got this incredible, like, I cannot tell, dude, the jealousy I feel for what you accomplished in terms of this voice cast for Stinker. It was, who, like, Rhea Seehorn, Andy Richter, right? Andy Daly for that one.
Or Andy Richards too, yeah. Yeah,
and John Hamm.
Tompkins. Yeah, John Hamm, Paul Tompkins. Well, that was really just one of those instances of just saying yes to something, not knowing what's going to work out. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it just working out, because I wrote a book, which the whole purpose was it was a novelization based on an imaginary movie from the late 70s. Called Stinker Let's Loose. So I put that book out myself because no one else understood it or wanted to put it out. So I just thought I'll self-publish it. And then some guy got in touch with me, and he said, if I sell this, can I make it into an audio project? And I thought, sure, why not? Not expecting anything. And then 2 months later, you know, John Hamm's involved with it, and Paul F. Tompkins, Ray Seahorn, so it became this thing that I never could have predicted. But I do think it's a good lesson in the sense that I think one should always just continue to produce rather than pitch, because oftentimes when you pitch, they can't really understand what you're getting at. And I think it's important just to have something tangible. And because I had something tangible, like a book, it became something else that I never could have gotten off the ground if I had just pitched on its own.
No, that is the photo of you, because you did a live performance of it in San Francisco, I believe.
Yeah, that was at the San Francisco Sketch Fest at the Castro Theater.
That cool. That was, he's with literally all the entire cast.
That's
yeah.
Awesome.
And like when I told people, anytime you come up and I'm like, he's on the show or I'm working with Mike or I just talk to Mike, I just pull out like my crumpled dot matrix printout of that photo. I'm like, here, it's this. And I'm so proud.
Yeah, it's this guy. Well, yeah. I mean, what happened was that's me trying to look cool. And I look like I'm either specially abled or like I slithered forth from some sort of swamp. If you see me, you know, I look way-faced and off. And if you had told me as you were shooting that I was going to look that bad, I really thought I was as cool as a cucumber. Right? But when you stand next to John Hamm,
right.
Yeah. My mistake was trying to look cool. I mean, all I should have done was smile, right? this is the world's most handsome man on the right, and then you have me to his left. It's a hard thing to compare with. So meanwhile, I'm stuck with this goddamn photo where I look like Benny Hill. All these, bloated and confused and...
Giving that little salute.
I wasn't drinking.
Oh, my God.
I do look off, you have to admit. I do not look like I'm fully there.
You look like you weren't aware that the photo was being taken that exact second.
Yeah.
I picture you a few seconds later being like, wait, he didn't say three. When was the photo taken? And, that was it.
Oh, no. No, I was fully aware.
Locked and loaded. Cool guy sex. So Passable and Pink, did that, I know you were writing that, but did that go straight to audio, this new project, or will there be like a written component with it as well?
Yeah, the contract is that it's coming out as audio first, and then 6 months after, it comes out audio November 14th, and 6 months after that, I will be putting it out as a book.
Okay. Do you want to just give us a taste of what exactly goes on in this? Because I'm thinking Breakfast Club, I'm thinking Pretty in Pink, I'm thinking that little shit Ferris Bueller, who you hate with all of your heart, and I love that.
Yeah, I hate him. I saw that in the theater and was repulsed at the time. I mean, to this day, I think he's a sociopath. He really he's a vile, horrible kid. I hate him.
Manipulator of his friends.
Yeah. Poor Cameron.
Yeah, the whole movie, I didn't like it. I still don't like. But, revisiting those movies now that I have a daughter is interesting because well, first of all, I wanted to do an 80s to follow up with the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching, all these movies I love, 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, and they do not age. I mean, it's interesting. I'm looking at it as an adult and a father now, and I found it really whiny. And some of the scenes in 16 Candles, especially with Long Duck Dong and the rape scene, I mean, all that stuff, it's just not – He's more closely to the 70s National Lampoon era than it does now. It just struck me as almost like a sci-fi film. But I did love it at the time, and there's something to be said for his writing. I mean, he's great, John Hughes. So it's sort of a mashup of all of those movies that I grew up with and sort of done in a surreal way. Adam Scott plays the Richie. Ray Seahorn plays the best friend to the Molly Ringwald type character, who's played by Gillian Jacobs. And then there is the Ferris Bueller type character, or the guy in Pretty in Pink, Ducky. The Ducky type character is played by Bobby Moynihan.
Nice.
where in this version, he's actually, he lives in the school. He's a wild child who was born and raised in a school, and he lives in behind the scenes in the school and watches things go on. And so it's sort of a mashup of all that. And then I got the same guy who did the Stinker Let's Loose music, Mark Rozzo, mm-hmm. who knows everyone. And he reached out to 80s bands, Psychedelic Furs, Dexys Midnight Runners, you know, even more recent bands, Guided by Voices, to do sort of an 80s style John Hughes soundtrack.
God damn, man.
That is so cool.
Yeah, I didn't know about the bands. Good Lord. Screw comedy,
well, it's
music.
A full band. It's musicians from each of those bands, yeah. But like, I think they looked at it as kind of a fun project where you just say, listen, write a John Hughes type song that would appear in one of his movies and take it from there. Yeah, so that, I mean, this is coming out November 14th. And then I just finished the third in the trilogy, which will take place in the 90s. I don't know if I told you this.
No, I did not
this
know.
This is like Singles and Reality Bites and all those horrible movies, Gen X movies from the early 90s. That'll hopefully come out next year.
Oh man.
I'm excited for that.
Yeah,
too.
Tell me Clerks is in the mix, man. I loved Clerks as a,
oh, Clerks is definitely in it. Yeah. All that stuff. All that.
Maybe a little Empire Records.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, actually a lot of Empire Records and a lot of Suburbia's in it.
Awesome.
Damn.
Oh, yeah. So cool.
I don't know, man. That's what I love about Mike. Like, he puts out these projects and people are like, I want in on this.
Yes.
Versus when I have to hold Eva down to get a voiceover for the show.
Stop it. He's kidding.
So, Eva, what do you work in comedy down in D.C.?
I don't at the moment. I moved to New York to study acting. I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and I moved home about 4 years ago, and I've known John since, God, I don't know. I was like six. You were.
It's been a long time.
My brother and him were little league buddies and smart kid class buddies together. And
yeah.
I always hitched my wagon to him whenever whenever I would come home. I'd be like, please let me do something with you.
Why did you move home?
Oh, a lot of reasons, just family stuff, but I had to get out of New York. It wasn't a really healthy place for me to be.
An Asian kid barfed on her.
Yeah, I was that woman with the pumps on the subway.
That kid's all over, man.
Yeah. No, I miss New York. I was there for 11 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really, really do.
Well, so where are you living now, in D.C.?
No, I'm back at home with Mom and Dad in Chantilly. Live about 3 minutes away from John.
Oh, yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
That makes one of us.
Yeah, we're best friends.
Well, if you're going to live in Chantilly, John's a good buddy, a Chantilly buddy, right?
Yes, he is. He is. And he's always welcome over to the house for cookies and soda.
Yes, all the snacks. It's great. Yeah. Even at 38, you can live the life of a child.
Yes. No, but it's something that I want to, you know, get back into. So I have a pretty good normal person job here, but it's unfulfilling and boring.
I was more than happy to give some of the roles for Why Not Me Too over to Eva. She smashed him, and I'm just like, why are you here in Stinkville? Why don't you go back to New York?
I would love to go back to New York.
But I'll tell you, it's good that you have a two-track system where you're making money, but then also doing what you want on the side. I think that's a smart way to approach it.
Right, and, you know, not getting any younger. Got to have that health care. When I was in New York,
yeah,
I was like 22. Yeah. I didn't care if I got sick. I would just, you know, never go to the doctor, yep, or never anything like that. I was invincible.
Yeah, just do a couple rails and sweat it out.
Exactly. Have some coding.
I don't even think it matters now where you live. You can live anywhere and do this stuff.
Exactly. So,
I mean, yeah, anytime I talk to you, I wind up feeling a lot more positive about things because you pretty much will conclude everything by saying that, like, just create, doesn't matter where you are, just get it done. The internet's the great equalizer. And then you start, bitching about the Angelos family and how they've run the Orioles into the ground.
No kidding, man. Well, you know what's interesting about the Orioles is if you go on the Facebook, how negative those fans are against, they're rooting for Houston.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Baltimore fans hate D.C. sports teams,
really?
Whereas D.C. people feel like, you know, a lot of love, I think, for the average Baltimore team. Like, I certainly enjoy the Ravens and the Orioles.
I used to go to Orioles games when I was a kid.
They goddamn hate D.C. teams.
I loved Camden Yards. And I had the I had the Cal Ripken bobblehead,
of course,
as a child.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think part of the thing is there's a lot of money was siphoned away from Baltimore TV wise from the Nationals, and there's a real anger towards the Nationals and their fans. And also, quite frankly, the Nationals are good. So the anger really shocked me that I couldn't believe. Because I'm rooting for D.C. I mean, I'm not going to root for Houston.
No. God.
Home of Beyonce? Boo.
Bay.
Mike, I thank you so much for calling in, man. I'm looking forward to the project. I pretty much renew my Audible just to buy your stuff and then wait for the occasional free credit they'll toss my way. But again, it's November 14th, Passable in Pink, an incredible voice cast. You can go on YouTube right now, and there's like a little behind-the-scenes video with the four main players, and it just sounds incredible. I'm looking forward to it. You've tweeted a ton through the years about the Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller's, and I can't wait.
Well, that is true about the Breakfast Club, and this sort of plays a part in the new project. I mean, when I watch Breakfast Club now with my daughter, the character I emphasize with the most is the poor janitor who just wants to do his job and get the fuck home.
He was always my favorite.
I know, he's a poor guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rest of the kids yapping away, you just want to fucking shoot them. But this guy, I feel such a sympathy towards because he's exhausted. He's working on a weekend and he has to deal with these kids. But that definitely plays a part in Passable in Pink. And actually, Judd Nelson, who was so mean to the janitor in Breakfast Club, plays the janitor in this new production.
Oh, my God.
Call the janitor.
Amazing.
Yeah, if you want to know my worldview, my very first therapist recommended to me when I was 13 to watch that film. And I think I spent the entirety of high school just wanting to be John Bender. I wore flannels, everything. I saw him. I didn't walk out of that thinking Estevez or the nerd. I was like, nope, give me the one who had a cigar put on his forearm.
You see this? This is what happens when you don't take the paint cans out.
That's another thing. Watch it now. He don't look so tough now.
No, not so much. Just a little shitty teenager.
Yeah.
Mike, thank you so much, man.
Oh, thank you. I love you guys. Thank you so much.
I miss
Nova, and let's talk again soon.
All right. Sounds like a plan. Bye.
Bye.
All right, buddy. Bye.
Did you like the bah I gave him? It wasn't a bye.
Yeah, it was
bah.
Like you were in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Bah.
Bah. And then I hurl fried dough at him.
They're called beignets down
beignets.
There.
Beignets. Again, Mike Sachs. I did... Why Not Me Too with him a couple of months ago. That was like his really slummy project before he did this great thing. I'm like the fat girl. I'm a slump buster.
You
know,
why?
Like he pumped a few in me and now he's banging a nine again.
Aww.
Aww. I fucking love Mike Sachs. As he said, I think it's at Michael B. Sachs on Twitter.
Yeah.
But I'll be tweeting and, you know, putting up all his info. I'll be putting up personal numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not? He loves, he said, I was kind of zoning out, but he said he liked pictures of, like, gay dudes into lawyers, right?
Yeah, I think so.
So
I'm going to ask for his social security number.
He'll give it to you.
Okay.
In exchange for some codeine.
Okay.
That's the Sachsian way. All right, I guess that is the interview. And again, Passable in Pink, November 14th, Audible.
Ooh.
If you join Audible and you haven't done it before, they'll give you the first book free. It's like a freebie credit.
Yep.
And I think if you wait a year, you get another freebie credit. Because I've definitely had a couple of free books. But yes, Passable in Pink, Mike Sachs, he's the fucking man. Eva, thanks.
Of course.
I hope that Mike makes us both famous somehow.
That was really cool talking to him. He seems like a really cool, funny, genuine guy.
He is. He's the best. All right. Till the next one. We are out of here.
Later.